Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Rowing Chat. I'm Rebecca Caro. I started this podcast in 2013, and it forms the basis of a hub for a load of different podcasts, all of them about the sport of rowing, presented by lots of different people. You can subscribe on our website, which is www.rowing.chat, and you'll get a weekly email with a link to every show that is published during the prior week. We look forward to welcoming you there. Now, Rowing Chat wouldn't be possible without our sponsors. And this month, we are supported by the Rowing Directory. This is a project, again, I have started because there's nowhere I could find that listed every single rowing business. We know that there are some multinational businesses that have representation in lots of countries. We know there are local businesses that sell internationally. And so I decided that I'd start the Yellow Pages for Rowing. You can find it on the Rowing Chat website. It's rowing.chat, and then find the word directory, which is in the main menu. I'm in the process of building it up, so I'd welcome any suggestions for firms that aren't yet published there. But in the past couple of weeks, we have had updates from the following organizations: from Rower Academy, who help youngsters get selected for American universities, from the Coffee Corporation, who make the Swingulator indoor rowing machine where you can join many ergs together, Latanzo Rowing Parts, who sell spare parts for rowing, the Wave Magazine, which is the coastal and offshore rowing magazine, newly started, an event, the San Diego Crew Classic, which is virtual this year. So if you want to take part, check them out. From Volare Sports, who sell clothing, and Ready, Set, Row Rowing Camps, which are about coaching the psychology of approaching rowing, led by a very innovative team out of the USA. And lastly, Hudson Worldwide, the boat builder. So this is a listing for their headquarters, and it has a link through to their website where you can find your local Hudson rep. I'm Rebecca Caro, and I'm going to be joined today by an amazing quartet of women. Welcome to Rowing Chat.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello.
So the purpose of today is we're calling it Voices in Rowing because there is a wonderful book called Voices in Rowing, but let's kick off by having each of my guests introduce themselves. So Daniela.
Hi, I started to row, I guess I was like 6 years old by an accident. I was with my dad, some training camp. I really got into rowing when I was 10, again with my dad, grew up rowing, sculling, doing all kinds of things, ended up at Washington State for scholarship, and that's where my career kind of ended. I started to coach at Presbury Sculling Center on and off, and then returned back to the competitive international sculling for the next, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. And during this whole time, I was self-funded athlete. And that's where my interest in rowing and what's the stories there started.
So Daniela Nachazlova is from the Czech Republic. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Fantastic. Now, Lucy Patkova.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for having me, Rebecca. So my name is Lucy, and I am from the Czech Republic. I'm a friend of Daniela, and she didn't mention yet that she's the author of the book Women's Voices in Rowing, and I am the agent, media agent, and the editor of the book. I am not a rower myself.
Please don't apologize. Everybody is welcome. And Michelle Carpenter.
Good morning from a rainy Ireland. I started rowing at the age of 13. I was one of the first woman members of Shannon Ryan Club in Limerick. And I went on and rowed to under 23 level at Commercial Rowing Club in Dublin. And I started being involved in rowing, I suppose, over my whole life, but primarily with Rowing Ireland when I started the Get Going, Get Rowing programme. And I've taken over as CEO of Rowing Ireland since 2018. So a journey there that was interesting.
Mm. And we're not going to go into detail about that now because actually that's your story, isn't it, in the book?
Yes. Yeah.
Now, Women's Voices in Rowing is the book that we're meeting here to talk about today. So let's kick in. Daniela, what's the background to this book? What gave you the idea that women's voices were worthwhile listening to?
Well, pretty much it started that I am probably like a, you know, reading geek. So every single book that comes out of rowing, fresh over the print, I have it in my library. And then it was, it's pretty crazy. It started when I wrote the methodology for Czech rowing, that I went through, you know, all the stuff that you can read about current rowing and wrote it for the Czech rowing, thinking that, okay, this would be great. I will change, you know, how, you know, the preparation of the future athletes, and that nothing really happened. What really resonated with people back then were the interviews at the end of the book, that like with Milan Dolacek, you know, coach of Ondřej Sinek, then with Ondřej Sinek, they were the parts of the methodology that resonated the most. And then here we go, the 2020 came with Tokyo Olympics were supposed to happen, and it was supposed to be gender equality for us rowers. And then I looked into my library, seeing only like two books from female rowers, thinking, oh, there's a huge discrepancy. And then with a bit of research, you find out even in the media, sports media, that females, you know, female athletes are being, you know, completely pushed to the side. So that's where it all started. It's like, huh, that's interesting. Why nobody really, you know, paid attention to it?
And hold up the book for us, Daniela.
Oh, yeah, here we go.
Hey. So there we go. So Women's Voices in Rowing is a series of interviews where you have selected a diverse range of women from around the world. How did you draw up the list?
Oh, I kind of had my wish list, let's say, at the beginning of like the 12 people I was thinking that would be interesting to talk to. And people from FISA, definitely Sheila Stephens, helped me to make it happen. And then at the end, I, you know, Michelle, who is here with us, was the last one, because I drawn to her as I was doing the interviews with the other ones, because her name was mentioned there like a few times. So basically that, you know, increased my curiosity there. It's like, you know, who is this person?
And just talk us through the range of questions that you ask in each chapter.
Yeah, I would say it was kind of divided. It depends if the person was like current rower, like for example, Emma Twigg or Ursula Grober, who just recently retired, that it would be going through their rowing careers. Then if they would be, you know, already retired for some period of time, it depends what they were doing. Like for example, you know, Tricia Smith, the head of the Canadian Olympic Committee. I was more interested in the governance, same with Michelle or Anna-Marie Phelps. And then when I had Judy, I know her that she does amazing stuff with, you know, sustainability and green stuff, and you know how she leads the business. So to each person, there was like the basic was kind of the same, the core, and then each of them kind of led its own way. And then the underlying message was from each woman started to be like, yeah, we are females, we feel like athletes, and we just want to be treated like athletes, but sometimes it's difficult. And that started to like really pop out of there.
And that commonality, that message comes through extremely clearly in 12 different interviews.
14 actually, yeah. Yeah. So
at a macro level, is the female experience of rowing different from the male experience?
I would say it depends where you grew up, where you started to row, where you learned to row, which system you pretty much started. I would say that was clear to me. And also which era.
Give us some examples.
Yes. Yeah, so Karen Davies, her experience rowing in the United States, rowing with Harvard was like a, you know, the 21st experience, like I hadn't had any issues at all. Instead of like Judy Gear, she started in a girls' school, and she said, oh my God, we were supposed to just do a pretty rowing, nothing like competitive rowing, and I didn't like that. And then with me, when I grew up, I didn't think too much about it. I was treated like as the boys, which I was fine with it. And later on, it's just becoming difficult that the better I got, they would say, but you're a girl and we don't support girls. And I'm like, why is that? I'm equally better. I'm equally good, or sometimes even better than your male. So why wouldn't I get the support? oh, because you're not our priority. I'm like, where the priority comes from? You know, what's the reason for it?
Yes, it's interesting how you're not looking for it, but sometimes the anecdotes really scream out. And Emma Twigg in her interview talks about how the New Zealand team has four women's crews who have qualified Olympic boats and only two men's. And the headlines talk about Hamish Bond, who was half of the Kiwi pair, being selected into the eight, which is a crew that hadn't even qualified, but still has not qualified for the Tokyo Olympics. And she was like, but what about us? We've got four crews who are already selected. Is this something, Michelle, that you see happening in the Irish media?
Not so much in rowing. We're quite lucky in Ireland that Sunita is considered the same as the O'Donovan brothers. And actually, she's she's become the golden girl of Irish rowing in the last number of years, particularly when she won the European Championships last year. And I think that's really good because she represents everything that is Ireland. You know, she's an immigrant, she's a mother, she's overcome so many things. But I think we had a very interesting campaign in Ireland that I was involved in called 20 by 20. So it's 20% more by 2020. And that was to get, one of the pillars of that was to get more media. And when with our own national sports, particularly the Gaelic Athletics, the GAA, which is very provincial based in Ireland, I think there is a lot of differentials. And there was a big push last year or the year before COVID, to get, you know, equal numbers in stadiums, watching women's games to men's games. So we're very lucky in rowing, even though we came from an era where, you know, I wasn't allowed to row because I was a woman, and there was many clubs in Ireland that didn't accept women. And we were on a really fast train, really, to where we are then today. And I think we've overcome an awful lot in the last number of years to get there.
And if I understand you correctly, it has taken the 20 by 20 program to push that agenda.
Yeah, and there's a number of very other interesting issues as well. Like there's Sport Ireland have a Women in Sport lead and have invested huge money into women in sport. And it's primarily, you know, all the sports are at so many different levels in Ireland. Like some have issues with participation, some have issues with media, and I think that's a general issue. Like in rowing, and I think that's a general worldwide issue, although the Southern Hemisphere is much better, the big issue is coaching and female coaches and encouraging female coaches. And that's why, you know, we have Claire Lamb, who's our Women in Sport lead on board, and she's doing all these initiatives, as well as the Return to Rowing initiative and trying to get people back rowing, to see it just not only as a competitive sport, but it's a sport for all and a sport for life.
That's very interesting indeed. So let's track back to the theme of the book, which is women's voices in rowing. So why do you think women's voices need amplification, Lucy?
From my point of view, as I said, that I am a newbie to rowing, I think it's very important to give the examples to young women or girls, because I've never heard about rowing before. I knew about it only from Daniela when I met her about 2.5 years ago. So it was the first time, and I was thinking like, okay, so there is another sport that young women or girls can start doing, because I heard about just male rowers a little bit from the media coverage, but I wasn't thinking about that it could be a sport that I can do. And from what I was reading so far, it's a great sport, and it's definitely worth a try. So why not to have this book and these amazing ladies that are behind that to show what you can manage, what you can achieve if you work hard. It's not only about sport, it's also about, because as we mentioned, Michelle, is also about the structure and about where the sport should go. So she's working hard, and she can show the example that when you have a dream, when you want to do something, when you want to change, you can do it if you are working hard. And it's great to have the people to follow, ladies, women to follow.
So when you were in high school, Lucy, do you remember ever having visitors to the school who were female sports people?
Female sports people, yeah, because I was in a sport a lot. I was attending a school where we had even more physical education lessons. I was playing volleyball by myself and did some other sports. And I was, for example, I had a classmate, Martina Sablikova, who is the speed skater. So I was surrounded by athletes, ladies doing skiing as well. But it wasn't rowing at all.
Oh, I mean, my experience from my British high school was I have no recollection of any athlete, and I was at a girls' school, female or male, coming to talk to the entire school about what they'd done. I do recall one of our gym games mistresses, she represented Great Britain in lacrosse, and we all got very enthusiastic at lacrosse and got quite good at it, but, you know, with good coaching. But I don't remember being presented with role models in that way. Michelle, was that your experience?
Yeah, but I think Sonia Sullivan stands out with me.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so she would have been a huge role model. And I think as rowers, as junior rowers, we were always dragged into doing everything, you know, cross-country running or, you know, because we were seen to be fit and training like crazy people, you know. But Sonia Sullivan, but I think, yeah, going back to the whole, there's a big emphasis on the Gaelic athletics in Ireland, the GAA, and that's also male-dominated, you know, the huge stadium filled, you know, supporting Dublin or Kerry or whatever county you're in, and then everyone leaves, and it's the women's game is somewhere else, somewhere smaller. No more than the rugby, it's the same, isn't it? There's a drive. And actually, it was brilliant last week to see that Lynn Cantwell has been appointed as high performance manager for the women's Springboks. So we're getting there, but it's chipping away at the chisel, isn't it, and the stone, you know?
It is. There's an advert for Sky TV here in New Zealand at the moment that basically is basically saying summer of sport and highlighting what's coming up. And the little clips that they do of lots of different sports, interestingly, opens with the New Zealand women's cricket team. Oh, and I was like, which given that this country is kind of sport mad. I mean, if you watch the evening news here and you've got a 30-minute news bulletin, sport isn't an afterthought. It's quite often fully 10 minutes at the end before they do the cat caught up the tree, you know, or the, you know, person they call them a good sort to who's been helpful and done amazing things in their life. Actually, sport is really important. So we'll have reporters who will cover the National Rowing Championships with film cameras, as well as, you know, reportage, you know, written reports. They will cover the secondary schools sports events as well here, but even that was notable for me as a that's quite a big change.
Yeah, there's a really good ad after coming out on TV here for the women's Gaelic team, and they're playing, I think it's Gaelic football, up a hill on the side of a cliff. And it's all about, I'll send it to you guys, it's all about overcoming diversity and overcoming issues. And we can get over it. We are the same because we are strong. And it's sponsored by Lidl, you know, the supermarket. So there's lots of really good things happening and lots of really good sponsors and people coming in behind to support equality, you know, because nobody wants to make a big agenda out of it. We don't want to be chaining ourselves to railing or anything like that, but it's important that everyone gets equal viewing and equal footage.
Let's talk a little bit now about structural issues. So sport is organized from a governance point of view, from, you know, FISA, the International Olympic Committee, down through Rowing Ireland, down to club level. Michelle, you have worked across a lot of those. What do you observe in terms of the structure and the organization?
I think in rowing we're a lot further ahead than other organizations, and I actually think FISA have done a really good job on that, in supporting women. You know, there's really good equality on the commissions. I mean, you've Gwyn Batten, you've Rosie Mae Golding, you've Anna Marie Phelps, you've Tricia Smith. So I think from a structural issue, I believe that World Rowing have really pioneered that equality, and that you know, that diversity on their committees. I guess then if you filter down to countries, it's very different. It's very diverse. You know, there are countries who have it, and then there are countries who don't. I think there's only two or three female CEOs or secretary generals. So you can see there, I mean, how many rowing nations are there across the roles? There is a gap. And even going to the OF, the Olympic Federations, then obviously the International Olympic Committee is pushing for the gender equality. Obviously it needs to happen in Tokyo. Also, you know, for athletes. But I think the European Olympic Committee, there's elections coming up shortly, and I think it's really good to see the amount of women going for election for the European Olympic Committee. So again, I think it's that chiseling away at the block. I think it is happening over time, but it's just going to take time.
So imagine, you know, that scenario that you've described. How can someone in a local club at their local level encourage a movement towards, let's say, firstly, encouraging women to stand for going on committee?
So we've done a lot on that, and actually that's where Claire Lamb, our Women in Sport lead, has really come in to find those women at local level. And we had an initiative a few months back where we asked women who would like to go on a leadership journey. So we have a high performance coaching pathway where we've a number of women on. And in fairness, our high performance team have been brilliant at that, led by Antonio Mauro, where the high performance coaches have come down, the female coaches have come down to our National Rowing Centre and are shadowing our high performance coaches to see if we can bring them on the pathway. And we've done a similar thing with women in leadership, in that we've asked people to nominate themselves or clubs to nominate them to come forward to go on a women in leadership course, which has been online. But actually the same thing, we've seen people not quite under that, but maybe who aren't there to go on that. So we're going to work with them as well. So it's all about putting in process. And we've been really lucky to get the funding from Sport Ireland, because it's all very well saying, oh, we should do this. But if you don't have the resources and if you don't have the structure and the platform to do it, it's very difficult. And that needs to happen more so we can see change.
Is there a relationship between, and I'm going to possibly use the wrong phrases here, major and minor rowing countries? Until recently, I think I would classify Ireland, where rowing is not a major sport in the country. Is there a sort of relationship whereby you can go to other bigger rowing organisations in other countries and say, look, could you give us a heads up? Can we take a look at your documentation?
Yeah, and look, British Rowing is a huge entity. You know, it's got a big staff base. I mean, we still have only about 15, 17 staff in Rowing Ireland. So British Rowing, I think at one stage, had nearly 100 members of staff. So they have been really good. And we have a network of CEOs, and some of that was driven by World Rowing recently. We set up a network of CEOs a few years ago, where we meet at World Championships when that used to happen. So I know I can always pick up the phone, you know, and it's easier, I suppose, to the Anglophone countries, but I can pick up the phone to Andy in GB, or Terry in Canada, or Ian in Australia, and, you know, ask them, oh, have you got something on this? Or, you know, are you doing that? So, And they do it as well, vice versa, you know. So, and I think that's really important as well. And that's one of the things we set up from the whole Women in Sport project that we've done, was networks that you can pick up the phone or send an email and say, what do you think about this? Or how are you doing that? So, and that's really important. And I think from a world rowing point of view, that's because we are a small sport. Let's call a space state. You know, we are. And, yeah, I think that's really important that we cross collaborate. And I know Lucy Truchet in FISA is doing, or I think they're world rowing now, shouldn't even be saying FISA. I think she's doing some work on that, on governance and safeguarding at the minute, and she's been on as well. So I think the more that happens, the better. And isn't that the big advantage of the pandemic, that we've all discovered we can all be nearer, you know, through online?
Yeah, it is indeed. Daniela, have you seen any structural issues that you could call out or identify?
Yeah, that's exactly actually, I think, why the book had to happen for me, because like here in Czech Republic, nothing really changed for 30 years. And last fall, I had a discussion with some people from Czech Growing here, and I'm telling them, you know, in 30 years, nothing really happened. And they're like, you have to wait. And I'm like, I can't wait. I've been waiting for 30 years, and that's really, we are going backwards, not forward. So by having people like Michelle or Annemarie Phelps telling their stories, how the change is happening, can actually help different countries like myself, like me here, or in Slovakia, Latvia, where these little, let's say, post-communist countries definitely struggle with male dominance, and they're not willing to let go, meaning the power. They are attached to the power, and they don't want to lose it, and they don't want to being threatened by females. So my like not a really good experience was when I was running for the performance director here in Czech Republic, and for the interview, I was not only the only female there, but in the board were only guys, and the girl who brought us the water was the only girl around, and she was the secretary, and I thought, wow, about like 10 years ago, I probably would not think too much about it. But that morning, it really dawned on me that we will have an issue. And these guys were asking me questions, what style of leadership you are going to present? And I'm like, well, I'm obviously not going to yell at anybody. You know, I'm just like, you know, we are just going to have, you know, we'll try to work it through. And it was a complete foreign concept. So first of all, the question was kind of weird. And second of all, they probably were not happy with my answer. I'm like, I'm not going to push it with the force because, you know, look at me, you know, I'm 5'6". So I'm not, I just like physically can't. And that's why we need some kind of like change. I don't need to be the boss right this moment, but I'm here to show that something needs to, you know, change. And after that, I was like completely again, kind of like shut down that they would not even, you know, talk to me about. So that's why I think I did it, that more federations like, the former post-communist countries need to see by examples that it can happen.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation, isn't it? Because one of the things that I may be wrong, but my observation is that women are generally better at collaborating and coming to a consensus decision. And a lot of men prefer the leader from the front, you know, follow me men, you know, over the top. And I observe that in schools, children nowadays are studying in groups. They're being assessed and appraised for their examination results in groups. They're being taught group working right across the board. And that, I suppose, mode needs to feed through into other organizations. So, Michelle, you're a mum. What do you see happening in the high schools that maybe will or could be coming through into the workplace?
I think there's a lot. I've an 18-year-old daughter, and I think there's a lot of focus on, you know, I read a really good article yesterday, actually. Can't remember what newspaper it was in, and it really focused on being in meetings and being mansplained to, or being manterrupted, and men, like you said, Rebecca, men having that stronger voice and, you know, leading the way, and, you know, it's so important to have that collaborative effort, and not quite what the Japanese International Olympic Committee said, and that women talk too much. Women talk in meetings because of that collaborative effort, because of that different way of thinking. Well, maybe we shouldn't bulldoze our way through that. If we think of doing this and this, what about, would we achieve this instead of that, and, you know, break things down. So I think from my daughter's point of view, she's seeing that she can do whatever she wants, and that things are different. And again, I think it is getting through in schools. But maybe we're probably further ahead here than, you know, I don't know, than there may be in the Czech Republic or in Latvia or Japan.
Yeah, go on, Daniela.
Oh, I just want to say that's why I think like Michelle's story is so important. I was kind of shocked that in 1986 she wasn't allowed to row because she was a girl, you know. Now we are 2021, 35 years later, look where they are. They are leading by example for us, like smaller countries, that the change can happen rather quickly than, you know, in 30 years nothing really happened. That's to me is that, like, okay, let's get the word out and set an example for other, let's say, other girls who don't feel like strong enough. And I know, like, for example, here it's almost impossible to get in. You know, out of 40 clubs we have only one female president, and the rest, it's still, they are just kinda, I don't know what it is, you know. Like, really, to me, my biggest, you know, trying to understanding now is the concept of power. What motivates people to have power, you know? What is it, you know?
Come from the top, though. I think you have to, like, Sport Ireland has led it from us. I think the change in Ireland happened because the national lottery, and I think you remember that in the UK, Rebecca, you know, it was driven by funding or governance now, like it's driven, like all of these new initiatives are driven by. So if it's coming from the Department of Sport or, you know, your sports, you know, your international body, as in World Rowing, that you have to do it. I think then that has to be the driving force, you know. Even up until 1992, there were still clubs in Ireland that you couldn't, like when I moved to Dublin, I rowed in commercial rowing club because Neptune Rowing Club next door didn't take women. And so Tony O'Connor, who you probably know, Rebecca, from New Zealand Rowing, we left Limerick, he went into Neptune and I went into commercial because Neptune didn't accept women, you know. So it's just that tide of change, but it has to be driven from the top down.
And then, you know, talking about being driven from the top, that's where I see, let's say, myself, like an issue from World Rowing, that, okay, you have, let's say, rules or like what should be the numbers, but yet there's no policy for example, if something will not happen. Meaning, like, if I go to the website of British Rowing or Rowing Ireland, World Rowing, safeguarding is one of the main things right now. In Czech Rowing, it's non-existent. It's buried. And then somebody from World Rowing should be saying, hey, listen, guys, if you don't by such and such a time, you know, comply with what we set up as the rules, then either you will not be allowed to race for a year, because that's what's happening. And that,
so
to me...
Think
sorry, go ahead.
They need some form of sanction, some punishment.
Yes. Otherwise, it's just like, yeah, no worries, you know. Nothing ever happened to us, so why we should be even bothering with that? That's really what I see in Latvian Rowing Federation. They even don't have a president right now, so it's general secretary running the show. Czech Rowing, it's all about the funding. They want to get the money, but don't do anything that would really, you know, affect their current structure, because they're happy with it.
So apart from you applying for a high performance job, Daniela, are you aware of other jobs coming up and other women helping other women to apply for these jobs?
Not in my country, because there is really, we have a lot of female coaches actually coaching like the kids level, but there's no aspiration really go any further, because they just will be bullied. So why to go through the experience? Because there is no structure set for them, or like a clear pathway that would help them to go to the next step.
So and that bullying is known, is it?
Yes, it's part of the culture.
It's so unfortunate. I really feel for you guys. So let's try to, you know, end a little bit more on a positive note. One of the things that you write about, Daniela, in the opening of the book is something you call solutions journalism. What is this?
It's pretty much a journalism that is focusing on, let's say, results. Meaning that's where I said it in the opening, that sometimes you read some actual like events that, for example, right now, Texas is struggling with a lot of snow, a lot of ice. They don't have a hot water, electricity. And then the news moves to the next event. And then you always wonder, like, okay, so what happened to these people? The media world is happening so fast that there's no time for, let's say, solutions. And it's different to obviously investigative journalism where you are, you know, going after like the big cases. So this one, I was like really intrigued that through the stories, you can actually help with change. That's where it came from. That, okay, like, for example, like I said again, Michelle or Anne-Marie Phelps, their stories can help somebody in, you know, post-communist country, let's say, to start the change because they will see an example and they would, for example, you know, Google Michelle and will ask her, hey, I was really intrigued by your story. Can I ask you for some help?
Mm-hmm. And you started to write this book because you were introduced to this concept?
No, it kind of just like wrapped all together. That it suddenly started to make sense, you know, how to look at it. So my idea was that somewhere there's like the 14, 16-year-old girl who just started to grow and kind of sometimes feels like left alone because like the coaches doesn't understand her, whatever. So she just needs to, you know, dive into the book and occasionally read different chapters that might be, you know, relevant to her at that point where she is.
We talked about the...
Yeah, go ahead. That's what I would probably like when I was little.
We talk about the solution journalism at the summer school we've met with Daniela. So maybe you mentioned that in the book, Dani, as well. So that's how the idea came a little bit. And it makes a great sense to me because solution journalism is trying to provoke some discussion and go beyond, not just as Dani mentioned, to cover the story and then leave it where it is, but talking to people and maybe trying to find some solution which may not be perfect, but trying to find out what's working for some people so other people can follow and they can find their own solutions to any social problem. So I think this book very fits the topic.
So on top of that, yes, like from each sale of the book, we will donate a dollar or a euro, it depends what the currency is, to the World Rowing into their diversity fund. And I'm hoping that we will be able to raise, you know, enough money that one or two females should go through this like leadership course that, for example, Michelle experienced or some of the now developing coaches are experiencing. And that was also... There was at in the middle of October last year when I was at the European Championships in Poznan, the senior ones. I saw a poster that was about safeguarding. That if you at least feel harassed, please contact the safeguarding officer. We are here to help you. That was kind of shocking to me. So I contacted Anne-Marie Phelps and Tricia Smith, asked them if they can help me to actually get this poster at the end of the book. To me, that was important. So again, I'm trying to connect, let's say, all parts of the rowing world, you know, together in like a not good cause, but in like a something that makes sense, you know, to help us to move forward, you know, in a 21st century.
And did you get the poster?
Oh my God, yes, that was, I'm just going to find it there because I think that was important, yes. Harassment and abuse have no place in our sport. So it's the end of the book, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. Now, one of the things that I personally have enjoyed is social media. And I mentioned I started this podcast a while ago. Michelle, do you think that informal networks like, you know, citizen journalism or podcasts by rowing enthusiasts like me have a part in this solutions journalism to start to disseminate, you know, answers and ideas and concepts outside of mainstream media?
Oh, 100%. It is a huge part because I think the mainstream media are so focused on what they've been focusing on for so long. And that's certainly been the place in Ireland that with a lot of the bigger media outlets that they've just been focusing on one thing or one sport or one issue. And I think that's why, you know, things like podcasts and the newer ways of doing it, things. I mean, previously in Ireland, certainly, and I can only speak from my experience here, local newspaper was very important at chipping away, getting the local stories, getting right down to basics. And then the bigger spread, you know, journalists picked up on that. So I think in this day and age, then it's things like podcasts that you can think, oh gosh, I didn't realize that. Even though, you know, as a European Championships, you know, Sunita can row, and then, you know, a Czech male rower rows in the next race or previous race or whatever. So it's really important that we chip away at that again, and we continue the focus on it through other media methods and as well.
Now, I know that Rowing Ireland has done some podcasts with, is it Niamh Hayes?
Yeah, Niamh, yeah, our coastal rower, yeah, exactly, yeah.
So Niamh started out here on Rowing Chat and started doing a podcast called Irish Rowing, and then got noticed, obviously, by you in the Federation. What's she been publishing for you, and what service does she provide for connecting people in Ireland who are interested in rowing?
So she's been connecting a whole different range of people, from our high-performance athletes. So, you know, she's interviewed Sunita, Paul O'Donovan, Vinton McCarthy, Emer Lam. So to get that connection with the high-performance athletes and our clubs, because we're really focused. Like, we have four pillars of our strategy, and one of them is supporting clubs, because without our clubs, we don't have high performance athletes. So we really need to focus on them as well. So, and then she's also done some pieces on indoor rowing, our indoor rowing championships run by Joe Cantillon, and obviously gone back to basics with coastal and offshore rowing. This year we were able to hold our offshore championships here, which was the only championship we held last year in Ireland. Last year, not this year. Still early this year. So she's done a great job on that. And I think there's a few more coming up. I think Gary O'Donovan might be stalking somewhere in the background, ready to be interviewed. Not that he's shy, but
I think that's going to be a pub quiz question in future. Which was the only rowing championships to be held in Ireland? You heard it here first.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated by your focus on clubs. And I'm going to be really bold here. In my experience, national federations get kudos and recognition by sending people to the Olympics, and they don't get the pat on the back for supporting the clubs. But without the clubs, you have no high performance. That's self-evident. How are you focusing on the funding challenge at club level? Because the more we broaden the sport, the harder it is for people on a low wage, people with uncertain incomes, to be able to afford to pay a one-off, you know, check for a whole year's membership. And I think that there are some clear issues that are probably coming to the fore now. Are you seeing changes happening at club levels?
Well, of course, we're in disarray at club level at the minute, because people don't want to pay their membership check because they can't get rowing. I mean, there's no rowing clubs are closed in Ireland at the moment. So that in itself is a substantial challenge here. But we're positive that, you know, I think golf and tennis are giving a big push to get back, that it's relatively safe. Yeah, I mean, trying to get that mentality that, you know, that business model in clubs, and we will be doing some work on that shortly. I think the Australians have a good business model for some of their clubs that we can, again, look at them for best practice, look and see how they do it and how they run their clubs effectively. But we've put a lot of supports in place, and we've a whole lot more to do. Like, we're not fantastic by any stretch of the imagination, you know, around governance, around club structures, around how they're run, around bringing in revenue and that. And we'll be continuing to support clubs in that next year or this year. And also masters rowing. How do you go back rowing? You know, I mean, think the German model is that you have lots of masters rowing and then you've less junior rowing, whereas our model is you've loads of juniors and not so much masters. So, you know, how do you get people back rowing? You know, like me, or you know, I know you're big into masters rowing, Rebecca. So, you know, how do you get people back rowing? It doesn't have to be, your 14, 17 sessions a week. So working on that as well.
So there are a couple of interesting things that I've seen come through, you know, like you, I read things, you think that's interesting. The Australian funding model that you mentioned is that you lease your clubhouse to a restaurant or a cafe who take the upper floors, and that pays for the rowing on the ground floor, which is possible in some buildings, not possible in other buildings. One of the big challenges in terms of membership dues that I see rowing failing to grasp is that we ask people to join for a year. You take golf, I know for certain, but possibly tennis as well. They have a pay to play model. You can turn up, pay on the day, and use the facilities. And one of the things that I've started trying to introduce with zero success, I will say, in my own club, is to do something we call it twilight rowing. So people who maybe rowed when they were in high school, at university, we know they can row. We know they are safe. You know, let's be really clear. We're not doing this with a total disregard for safety and our equipment. But would they like to get back together with their former crewmates? Are they all still in the same city? Come together, have a barbecue afterwards, you know, do a little row around the lake. We called it a scrimmage regatta, where it's not a regatta, it's a scrimmage, which is an American phrase that basically means bundle a whole load of people from different clubs into one club, do composite crews, nobody has to trail boats around, you know, everyone puts $5 into a pot to pay for the tea and coffee and the inconvenience afterwards. And looking at different models of how do you bring money into the club. The main one, though, that I think has an ethical overlay is gambling. The lottery is gambling, and a lot of people have a big problem with it. And we have just on the cusp of seeing the launch of a brand new program here called Community. The idea being that merchants, retailers, sign up to this and they agree, instead of having their regular loyalty program that gives you a discount, you know, at the supermarket checkout, that they will donate them a percentage of the sale through the Community app. And then you have the app on your phone and you have up to 3 charities or sports clubs or whatever that you can nominate, that your 1% of your, you know, weekly shop, which would have been your loyalty reward, goes direct to the clubs. And the hope is that this will create an ongoing funding stream so that the clubs don't have to fill in loads and loads of paperwork to apply for grants. They don't have to worry about, you know, if the lottery funding, you know, withers up for whatever reason, or priorities shift, or, you know, rowing got support last year, therefore you cannot have support this year and it's going to a different sport. So all of those uncertainties that if actually rowing clubs can have their members and their members' friends nominate them for their loyalty payments, we might be able to create a rather different funding model, which would then give the clubs flexibility to do different things. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
No, it sounds really interesting. And then what I'm thinking is also that with the pandemic, we see, at least I see, a huge increase of sales of the indoor rowers. And now we are getting into the spring season. A lot of these non-rowers before, you know, learned a new sport on their own, and now, for example, here they would be looking, oh, where can I learn the sport? And the club are not ready for that because they are focused on the kids under the age of 18. Because if you get kid rowing, you get money, or kid do sport, because it's like the best prevention of not taking drugs. So the government throws actually money on the clubs for having these kids in, and once you pass the age 18, you are no longer valuable. And that's why we are like missing this kind of like between, you know, 20 to 40 age group, because the kids were used, you know, they made money and now nothing. You know? So that's, and now we have this, you know, paradox of like completely new people coming in, they would be banging on the doors and the clubs will just not be ready for them.
Yeah. Michelle, you're nodding vigorously.
And we've seen the success of Zoom Ergs, and we started a similar one. When I saw Zoom Ergs, I was like, I had that idea, and we were just later getting it organized. I I texted a friend and says, just to let you know, we're not copying you. We have that idea. But like we have Row with the Pros, and it's been a massive success. And we even expanded it last year last week because we'd midterm last week. So we had Pilates, we had yoga, we core with Claire. So, and that was great for clubs. So I think Daniela's right. Indoor rowing could be huge. And I know British Rowing are really focused on that. And even the Row with the Pros that we did, or someone said to me, push them with extra cushion for some people. that's, you know, what about people who've never rowed? Like there was some rugby players who have an erg in their house, and they were like, oh, well, we'd love to join, but like, we're not sure our technique is right. So what? We can teach you technique. It's simple, isn't it? You know, so there's so many ways of facets to do it. But I think one of our big problems here for clubs, and I don't know what membership is like in New Zealand, but our clubs, like, 100 euros a year for membership. I mean, my daughter was rowing last year. She was in the rowing club 14 times a week. I think she wasn't really misbehaving. You know, she was focused on training. She was, you know, not partying. You know, she was doing all the right things. For what else would you get for 100 euros a year, you know?
So I think that's a very modest membership. Yeah, I mean, memberships here are substantially higher than 100 euros. I can tell you that for sure.
Yeah. And kind of a mutualist, I can see like 200 euros, and then like, yeah, and then no wonder you are struggling, you know, for new equipment and, you know, funding, because you just don't think about it as a business. Everybody is trying to run it as a charity, actually.
That's absolutely right. There's a very influential LinkedIn post, which I will link to in the show notes, where this man basically came out and said, stop volunteering, start charging appropriately for your skill as a volunteer coach. And, you know, let's see if, you know, we're underselling the sport, was his basic message.
Yeah, I mean, look how we have to offer the boats, the oars, you've one-on-one coaching because of safety most of the time, you have an indoor gym, you have ergs, you've so...
Insurance.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah, and a bunch of friends, and sometimes a bar as well.
And a bunch of friends for life, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's why I think, like, that was kind of my curiosity a few years ago when I saw the rise of CrossFit and I wanted to understand the mentality, wanted to pretty much understand and be able to speak their language, let's say. So I did the CrossFit level one course and CrossFit for kids. It was expensive, let's say, the course. It was well-structured, but got you ready to be able to run your gym at the professional level, meaning not overcharging, but actually being able to make a living of it. And since then, I'm suggesting to all the coaches here, listen, go and do the course. It will open your eyes, not only, you know, how to do different exercises, you know, for cross-training, but also how to think about the sport as a business. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, that's so true. And again, you know, I know I started the rowing directory, but the rowing directory is there because there are actually some very innovative new businesses that, you know, I discover because I see someone who tagged someone on Instagram. I mean, you know how it goes. And then you do a little bit of digging and you go, well, that's interesting. I didn't know that existed. And I've discovered a summer camp for rowing psychology in America for young women, which is like, my goodness, who knew that something as innovative as that, you know, which is a program built from scratch by someone who's done, as Daniela said, done their research and then gone and worked out how to teach it and that people actually want to buy it. Yeah. I do think rowing actually can be quite an innovative sport, but our attitude to volunteerism and money does hold us back in some regards. I don't decry volunteering. I absolutely don't. But I do think that there is a balance that we've failed to take advantage of, and that leaves us vulnerable. It's a risk, you know, if funding gets withdrawn, what happens? And although everybody can pull together and, you know, make donations and cake sales and things, it actually isn't a long-term solution.
Yeah, and I see it as a result of it is here that we either have coaches who are young, just after the school, who have like no experience, and then they leave for real business, or you have the, you know, let's say retired coaches who are like in their 70 plus and they do it for the fun. But the problem with them is that they aren't going to read my methodology because they've been doing it for 50 years, so they know it all. So I have nothing really to, you know, teach them. And then you see the terrible stories, like they, you know, ride on the race course and they yell at these, you know, poor kids who just been rowing for a couple months, and they throw them into the national championships because they have to bring them points or medals. That means then the coaches get some money. It's like a completely, you know, it's a sick program, I would say.
The athlete-centered coaching methodology definitely isn't often known in the, you know, very long-standing coaches who haven't had to do any professional development. How do you manage that in Ireland, Michelle?
Well, we have a CERS coach education program, so we encourage all coaches to go on it. And I think most of the coaches have. So we have levels, you know, introductory level one, level two, level three. So, you know, if you've coached for a number of years, then perhaps, you know, you'd look at your skill set and bring you in at level two or level three and bring you up with that. But I think it's become part of the culture now. In fact, we've put all our introductory to coaching courses online, and our level one is going online shortly. And I think by the end of March, we'll have 200 people have gone through that now already in a number of months. So again, I think that's very well accepted, and it seems to be very important. The next struggle, I think, here for clubs will be governance and the focus on governance.
That to me is innovative, you know, like, you know, taking advantage of the pandemic and putting it online. So instead of saying, oh, we couldn't go there and access that, like, no, you can do it online. And to me, it's just like mind-boggling sometimes.
Well, it's been advantageous in many ways, but it's also brought out some just fantastic innovation and some ideas, and a recognition that rowing isn't just six lane, you know, 2K racing, that actually there's a lot more to the sport, and we need to be more accepting of, in my club, the mums group who just like turning up at the weekend and then going off to the cafe for a long chat after their row, you know, and that they have no interest in going and doing 1K racing. And how do you as a club accommodate the different desires, I suppose, of the membership? And that's a challenge, particularly when equipment's limited, when safety on the water is important. You know, so it's expected that kids will race. I've never heard of a club having a youth, you know, role, part of the club where the kids don't go and do regattas. But actually, for masters, it's quite important to have a non-racing, maybe recreational isn't even the right word, but, you know, a group of people who just enjoy getting out on the water and who can train alongside people who do want to race. But then how do you manage those conflicting objectives? And I've got all the answers, of course.
Yeah, interesting, yes. And that's just like, I think that just looking at it from a business point of view, not like the one that we got stuck into, it's really fascinating to see that the membership is so low in Ireland, and it's same here as well. And I'm thinking to us, it's some kind of leftover from the, you know, post-communistic era where sport was to some, you know, like a some sort of propaganda. So it was like, you know, to get you up at the med, you know, at the Olympics, get some medals, get the media interest, and then we don't really care. So now it has to change, but it has to come. Sometimes the changes to come from people from outside of the sport completely. So let's not shut it down, but just like try to figure out how everybody can work together, you know, diverse the club.
I definitely like the idea of the return to rowing. And, you know, in my club, all we do is we mention that we welcome adult beginners. Our challenge then is how to coach them, how to integrate them with the rest of the club. I mean, there are clubs, there are very high performance, part of our club is a high performance group, and they do not take beginners. You know, they're explicit that they don't. And yet, it's my view that if space can be found for people who, you know, even if it's just a bucket list thing, I've always wanted to try it. Well, okay, come and do a 6-week learn to row program and tick it off your bucket list. You know, at least you can say you gave it a go. But one of the things that we're looking at that I think will be hugely advantageous for the casual less skilled rower are these paddle boards where you can strap a rigger to the top of it, where you can row square blades. You don't have to have good blade work. You're not going to fall in. You know, the thing will go through meter high waves, so it doesn't have to be perfectly flat water. You know, I'm exaggerating to make a point, but the fact is that they're much more accessible equipment as well as accessible membership styles. And I think that this is something that I shall be very interested if that does, you know, feed through into the root and branch end of the community sport of rowing.
So you'll probably like my story. About 3 years ago, I got approached by a local Airbnb manager for Central Europe who asked me, hey, Daniela, you have to do rowing for everybody. And I'm like, yeah, that's part of my mission, you know, to teach everybody. So he helped me to set up this Airbnb experience, Row in Prague. So I got 4 stand-up paddleboards with the sliding rigger. And started to do. I have it on Airbnb and it's been great success. And 95% of the people who came never rode before, and exactly they wanted to try it. And we go to the downtown of Prague, and after, let's say, half an hour on the erg and basic introduction, I usually have them on a rope so they kind of feel kind of safe because I can, you know, pull them back. After that, we are ready to row. And these people are able to row 6K usually. We go into the downtown and we come back. And they're just amazed. And I'm like, this is the way. And again, I have it as an example for the local club saying, hey, this can be a business because I charge premium, to be honest, because it takes my time, but they're willing to pay it. No, the club say, oh, this is an awkward equipment. It has nothing to do with rowing. I'm like, that's part of your problem. You're so stuck on your sport that you will never see the innovation.
So here's what's so interesting. I also got approached by Airbnb and I set up a rowing in Auckland, and they said they didn't want to do it. I think because they didn't have enough travelers who want to come this far. This was way before the pandemic. But how interesting that you're the only other person I've met who said they took up that Airbnb opportunity.
Yeah, and the funny is they ran like a great, you know, press release and press conference. They send it out, you know, like the media kit. We send it to World Rowing and to all these, you know, bodies around the world. Nobody picked it up. You know, it was 3 years ago. It's like they were embarrassed that we are going to promote rowing a different way. So kind
of fun. We should talk offline about this because I think you're onto a good thing. I really do. But one of the things I've learned in business, and I've done several businesses, is that an overnight success takes about 8 years.
I'm there with you.
But think of what you can do with that, with Tokyo and the positivity that's going to come out of Tokyo. You know, everyone's, you know, all so stuck, so restricted at the minute. I mean, we can't go without within 5K and that's it here in Ireland. I really think that Tokyo is going to bring so much positivity to every nation around the world, just to see sport, to have sport on TV, to have, a you know, medals, hopefully, to have successes. And people, hopefully, by July, August, will start to be able to go out and will be knocking on doors of clubs around countries saying, I want to try that. You know, I want to be like, you know, the New Zealand men's eight or Emma Twigg, or, you know, I want to do that. So I think there's a huge opportunity there.
I totally agree.
Maybe also the pandemic, because people are looking for some new hobbies, right? What they should do. So why not try this? It can be helpful.
Absolutely. Guys, we've had a fantastic time. Thank you for your wonderful energies. Daniela, Lucy and Michelle, it's been brilliant. Remind people, Daniela, where they can connect with you and where they can get the book.
Yes, so it will be on our website, voicesinrowing.com. You can buy it directly of us. That's pretty much the best channel. For Europe, we have also Amazon account, but try to get it directly. We are like small guys.
Yep. The money, the donation goes to the World Rowing Diversity Fund.
And you can follow us on social media. I will just add Voices in Rowing on Instagram and also on Facebook. So we are happy to have you in the community, because what I've learned so far is that rowing is really such a supportive community. I can see from the ladies, from the voices and everybody that when we say something, we get really the nice feedback and support. So this is, it's so lovely to work in this field for me.
Well, we need to get you out and about. That's self-evident.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you all very much for your time, for your energy. Please follow Rowing Chat. We're rowing.chat is our website. You'll find all the social media links there. And if you'd like to come on the show or if you'd like to learn how to host your own podcast on the network, please get in touch. I'm Rebecca Caro, and till next time.